At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology. Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is really old. I mean, they're claiming that this is 3,000 years old. That puts it squarely in the old part of the Old Testament. Do you remember those? Well, it's come to mean something different. When someone's called a Philistine today, it usually means they're uncouth and they're uncivilized. But the Philistines in the Old Testament were formidable enemies. They were the sea people who, well, they just came in and kind of came out of nowhere. Where they came from, no one seems to know even to this day, and took over a lot of things and were the primary villains at a certain point in the Old Testament history. We're going to be talking about the reported discovery of a Philistine cemetery. Dr. Andrew Steinman joins us for this half hour of Issues, Etc. He's professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, and author of numerous books, including From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. Dr. Steinman, welcome back.
Good to be back, Todd.
One of the stunning things I found it interesting about this discovery is that it had been pretty much untouched, an entire cemetery, dozens of remains, completely untouched. How rare is that?
Well, for something like a cemetery, it is extremely rare to find it untouched. The problem with cemeteries is, in the ancient world, oftentimes people buried loved ones with items, and there were tomb robbers. This is not just true for, you know, pyramids in Egypt or graves of kings in Greece or something like that, but elsewhere. So it's pretty rare to find an untouched cemetery.
What do they claim to have found here? How would you describe it?
Well, they found, I think, about 20 remains of people in a burial site outside of what apparently was the ancient city of Ashkelon. From what I understand, the remains were left over a period of several hundred years, the oldest being, let's say, around the time of David, or perhaps a little earlier, Saul, and the latest being several hundred years later.
Let's talk about the people themselves. What would indicate that this is a Philistine cemetery as opposed to something else?
Well, I'm sure the first indication they took is it was outside of the site we identified with ancient Ashkelon. Ashkelon was one of five Philistine cities, according to the Bible. It's down on the coastal plain in what we would think of now as southern Israel, near the Mediterranean Sea, exactly where the Philistines in David's day were located. That right away would have made anybody who found it, and at this period of time that they can date it to because of artifacts that were found with it, the first thing you would think of is they're Philistine. Plus, some of the artifacts they found in the grave sites apparently match to types of wares, especially ceramics, that were known to be especially associated with Philistines. So putting that all together, it seems the most logical conclusion.
If someone asks you, who were the Philistines, what's your simplest answer?
Yeah, I'm not sure there is a simple answer. The Philistines we're talking about, at least in this era, seem to be people that came from across the Mediterranean Sea and settled on this strip of land in southwest Israel nowadays, near the seacoast. As I said, they were mentioned as having five major cities. So their origin seems to be that time, maybe from far western Asia, like Turkey. Some people in the past have suggested from Greece or Crete or somewhere else around the Mediterranean. And I think that's still up for grabs somewhat. But wherever they came from, they seem to have invaded. We know that a couple centuries before David, a number of centuries before David, that peoples from this area tried to make incursions into Egypt. The Egyptians repulsed them, and much of the theory is that they then went and settled on the coast further north, and that's the people we're talking about. And so it would seem that when we meet the Philistines who are mentioned in books like Judges or Samuel or later, that that's who we're talking about.
So no one is really sure of their origins. But they
no.
But we do know that they set where they settled, and the biblical account is very replete with their relationship with the ancient Hebrew people.
Yeah. They and during the latter period of the Judges and on into David's day, they are a major power on Israel's southwest flank. They certainly give Israel a lot of trouble. They seem to have mastered iron technology before Israel did. At one point, we're told in the book of Samuel that the Israelites, who I guess bought iron implements from them or other people, didn't know how to even sharpen them. They had to go down to the Philistines to get their plow, shares, and other implements sharpened. So the Philistines seem to have kind of an advanced technology that Israel didn't have during the days of, let's say, Saul and early in the reign of David. So they were you know, quite powerful people, and because they were had kind of the technological upper hand, they also at times were perceived as having the upper hand in war. We're told that, for instance, in Saul's reign, the Philistines had iron implements of war, like iron swords, but the only iron swords in Israel were owned by Saul and his son Jonathan. So, you know, a lot of times in war, the technology makes a big difference, and so it's no wonder that Saul is often portrayed as being afraid of the Philistines. Probably from a human standpoint, he had good reason to be.
Now, what were their what was their religion? Do we know anything from the Old Testament or from other evidence of what kind of religion the Philistines practiced?
Well, we do have some evidence. When the Ark of the Covenant is captured in battle by the Philistines, they put it in the temple of the god Dagon. Dagon is the god of grain and harvests, and so it probably indicates that they viewed him as the head of the pantheon. The fact that he's given the name Dagon probably shows us that they very early on adopted the language of the land of Canaan. And if they had series of gods that they worshipped that they brought with them from wherever they came, apparently they quickly identified those gods with the native Canaanite gods, because it appears as if they're using Canaanite names, at least. We don't know too much more about their worship practices. We don't have anything surviving, at least from the era of David, or anything, you know, fairly ancient from those centuries to describe, you know, all their worship practices. But we do know that that this god Dagon was very important, and perhaps considered the head god in the pantheon of gods that they worshipped.
What was the source of the hostilities from kind of the beginning of Israel's encounter with them? Israel enters the land. What would that be? What year would that be, B.C., when they enter the land with Joshua?
1406 B.C. was when Israel enters the land. The Sea Peoples' big invasion comes after that. And one of the before we can really answer kind of the source of animosity, I think one thing we should clear up the Philistines are mentioned as early as the book of Genesis, and they're mentioned early in the book of Judges. And liberal scholars have used this to say that Genesis and the early part, at least, of the book of Judges is not accurate, that it's historically an anachronism or something. But I think there are a couple things we should keep in mind. The identification of these people as Philistines is based on what we read in the latter part of the book of Judges and in the book of Samuel and so forth. And we don't know that there weren't a number of peoples that came earlier than this. And in fact, in the ancient Greek translations of the Bible, the word Philistine is translated by the Greek word for foreigner. And so when the book of Genesis, for instance, uses Philistine, there it may be using as a general word for foreigner from somewhere across the Mediterranean, and not necessarily a specific ethnic identifier. So we have to be careful, you know, what book we're talking about and what it actually might mean. But as far as the animosity that we read about, it apparently is a Philistine aggression tied to their perceived need to expand their territory. I mean, they have a rather narrow strip of land, rather small strip of land that their cities are located on. These five coastal cities that are mentioned in the Bible don't take up a lot of area. And so it may be that, you know, due to population pressures or maybe just due to wanting to expand their influence, they begin to attack Israel already in the days of the judges. We read them early on in the book of Judges, where a judge named Shamgar opposes them. And then the major thrust of the Philistines we meet later in the book of Judges when they're opposed by the judges, Jephthah. Well, they're mentioned as aggressive in Jephthah's day. He doesn't directly attack them, but also by Samson. And we're specifically told it's Samson's birth. When Samson's birth is announced to his mother and father, God specifically tells them that Samson will be the beginning of God's dealing with the Philistines. Of course, the end of that really comes much later under David. David is the king who finally brings an end to any active Philistine threat to Israel. So we might say for a couple hundred years before David, the Philistines had been trying to expand their sphere of influence in this part of the world. And since Israel is the neighbor right next door, that's who they attack most often.
We're talking about the reported discovery of a Philistine cemetery. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about David and the Philistines. One of the most famous Sunday school stories of all has to do with one of the big Philistines, David versus Goliath. Dr. Andrew Steinman is professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, and author of numerous books, including From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. There's a new neighbor in town. The Lutheran Federal Credit Union is open and ready to serve members of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. Lutheran Federal Credit Union provides checking and savings accounts, home, car, and personal loans, on-demand mobile banking, 30,000 ATMs, and 5,000 in the co-op shared network. You'll find the modernized banking experience you need with excellent customer service and security you expect at LutheranFCU.org. LutheranFCU.org.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th century. The 4th century. the best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
At Zion Lutheran Church, Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, we've adopted the motto, "A Changeless Christ for a Changing World." While many congregations try to market a message that appeals to what a changing world wants, we continue to give a constantly changing world what it needs. A changeless Christ in word and sacraments like the church has done for 2,000 years. If you're in Chippewa Falls and would like to have the forgiveness of sins, eternal life, and salvation that Jesus won on the cross and delivers today in his church, please join us poor, miserable sinners. For more information, visit cfzionlutheran.com.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Pilgrim Lutheran, Santa Monica, California. Emmanuel Lutheran, Terre Haute, Indiana. Trinity Lutheran, San Angelo, Texas. Trinity Lutheran and Emmanuel Lutheran, Holloway, Minnesota. St. John Lutheran, Schaumburg, Illinois. Our Savior Lutheran, Pipestone, Minnesota. Real Lutheran Fellowship, Rochester, Minnesota. Living Word Lutheran Church, The Woodlands, Texas. St. James Lutheran, Logansport, Indiana. St. John's Lutheran, State Center, Iowa, and Trinity Lutheran, West Chicago, Illinois. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. We're talking about a reported discovery of a Philistine cemetery. Occasions conversation on the identity of the Philistines. Dr. Steinman, in close parallel to the judge Samson's interaction with the Philistines, is David against the massive Philistine, Goliath. It's become kind of iconic in its reference. Even his name becomes synonymous with kind of an insurmountable or believed to be insurmountable obstacle. So let's talk a little bit about that story. And some of it, we learn a little bit about the Philistines. We have his armor described in some detail. And we know that he came from one of those five city-states that the Philistines had established. Pick up there if you would.
Yeah, Goliath comes from Gath. And he is described, along with apparently others in his family, as being fairly tall. And therefore, we get a big, long description of his armor and armament. He kind of wears the standard armor of the day, but the difference is, because he's such a large man, you know, the weight of his armor is so much heavier than anybody else's. And we're told that he has, a huge spear and obviously a sword. But he also, like most warriors, has a shield bearer that goes in front of him. We're specifically told when he comes out to fight David that this man carrying the shield goes out in front of him, which is not unusual for a prominent warrior. Of course, Saul has these when he goes out to war, too. So what we know about Goliath is his large size and his prominence as a warrior. David is offended because of Goliath's challenge to Israel. Goliath comes out and challenges Israel to this duel. They're both armies are on either side of a valley. Neither one is willing to go down into the valley to initiate the attack on the other. Nobody wants to be fighting uphill. And so there's this stalemate, and Goliath comes out every day and challenges them to a battle, kind of one-on-one, send somebody out. And whoever wins this combat between me and you, we'll consider the army to have won the battle. We'll settle the battle that way. Saul, who we are told is a rather tall fellow himself, doesn't want to go out and confront Goliath. He offers an award apparently, for anyone who would go out and defeat him. And when David, who's a young man and not in Saul's army, comes to bring supplies to his brothers who are serving in the army, he overhears this talk of the reward given to the man. And David's pretty incensed that nobody will go out and fight Goliath. And he specifically mentions Goliath slandering and blaspheming Israel's God. Now, what's interesting, I find interesting about that, is that the writer of Samuel doesn't tell us any of that specific blaspheming. He does tell us, you know, about Goliath's challenge, and that may be simply because he doesn't want to repeat the blasphemous phrases. But David, you know, gets incensed by this, and we learn something else about the Philistines here. David is incensed, he says, by these uncircumcised Philistines. So apparently the Philistines didn't practice circumcision. But of course, for David, that's a very important thing because it shows that they're not covenant people. That, and he's indignant because the covenant people of God, whom God has promised to be with, they don't have enough confidence to go out and fight this man. David might be seen as a brash young man, but I think we also should see him as one who's supremely confident that God keeps his promise to be with his people, and indeed his promise to be with Israel when they go into battle. So I think we see here more than just kind of the braggadocio of a young man. I think we see a young man of faith who's willing to confront this very tall man, Goliath.
In this story, when they encounter one another, Goliath scoffs. It considers it insulting, in fact, that, you know, he would come out against me like against a dog with a stick. But David goes, can we say, in military terms of the day, completely unprepared or almost completely unprepared to encounter this great warrior?
Yeah, he doesn't, when he comes out, he doesn't look like a warrior. They, you know, Saul tries to put his armor on David, but we're told that, you know, David has had no experience as a warrior. He can't walk around and maneuver in Saul's armor. And so, as most people who are familiar with the story knows, he goes really out with only his shepherd's sling and a couple stones to put in order to confront Goliath. And so Goliath sees not a man in armor who comes out, but a young man. And we're told that he specifically looks down on David because he is a young man. And he can determine that pretty readily because he's got no armor. All he's got is this sling. And yet he also has his faith that God will keep his promise to be with Israel when they go out to war. And so Goliath scoffing, I think, is a way of also the author of Samuel to show us, you know, how an unbeliever can only see kind of the physical realities of the situation, where David, as a believer, also knows that there are realities beyond what you can see with your eyes. And so, you know, this is, I think, an important point that the author is skillfully building up in this story of this encounter between these two men.
Finally, he's also signifying that David is the one who is going to, in many ways, finish the job begun by Samson. He's going to, in effect, kind of neuter the effect of the Philistines here, but it begins even before he's king officially. And
yeah,
it signals the eventual kind of eschatological defeat of this pagan nation. Talk about that with about a minute.
Yeah, well, David is very interesting in that he goes out and becomes very quickly a general in Saul's army and goes out against the Philistines. And once Saul starts rejecting David, David eventually, ironically, ends up as a mercenary for the Philistines in the city of Gath, precisely where Goliath was from. But even there, he's faithful to God because he deceives the king of Gath into who he's attacking. the king of Gath thinks he's attacking his fellow Israelites, but David is actually attacking other enemies of Israel in the land. When David eventually does become king, the Philistines go on the attack again very early in order to try to knock David out of the game, so to speak. And David consults God. The book of Samuel tells us he gets instructions from God exactly how to attack the Philistines. And at that point, after defeating the Philistines never again become a big threat to Israel, at least as long as David and Solomon are on the throne. And really, they never become a major threat again to the kings that succeed David and Solomon.
It's often said that the spade is the Bible's best friend. What are your final thoughts with regard to this reported discovery of this Philistine cemetery and its place in biblical archaeology?
Well, I think it does show us, you know, that the Bible is not just making up historical fictions or something like that. It confirms that there were people living in Ashkelon. They do seem to be a people from originally from outside the land of Israel. They're not a Semitic people. And though, you know, it's not like we found Goliath's bones or anything like that, they do show us that the Bible is set in a truthful historical setting. And even if we can't confirm every detail in the Bible, I think we should be comforted to know that it's not as if this is totally improbable narrative. In fact, the narrative is set in a time that gives us confidence in the details that we may never be able to confirm.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago. He's author of numerous books, including From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. You can find out more about this excellent resource under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Dr. Steinman, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
When we come back, we're going to go to our series, Top 3 Verses. Pastor Brian Wolf-Miller will join us. He has picked out the top 3 verses on the office of the ministry. It's going to take us to John 20, Jesus' appearance after his resurrection, 1 Corinthians 4, and Acts 20. We'll be looking at those 3 top verses on the office of the ministry and talking about the pastoral office with Pastor Brian Wolf-Miller right after this.
For 20 years, we've lifted our voices and instruments to the hymns of Stephen Starkey. Now, CPH has the first ever CD collection of Pastor Starkey's works titled, We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God. This 12-track CD includes nearly an hour of music from the most beloved Lutheran hymn writer of our time. Order now. Use promotion code URA. We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God is only $15.99. CPH.org.
In my family, education means cultivating wisdom and virtue by teaching what is good, true, and beautiful. Memoria Press makes this type of education possible with their classical Christian curriculum. Characterized by simplicity, quality, and affordability, Memoria Press gives my children a rich classical education. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We Lutherans were never aided by following along with some other tradition's theological priorities and catchphrases.
Issues Etc. regular guest, Pastor Heath Curtis, Coordinator for Stewardship for the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod on a Lutheran approach to stewardship.
Other folks are not approaching it from our good, solid Lutheran understanding of law and gospel and vocation. There's a place to talk about this in Christianity, and we have a way of talking about stewardship as Lutherans without ever using the word stewardship, if you like. I'm going to talk to you today about your vocation. in your home, in your church, in your society, and how each one of these makes a claim on you, on your presence, on your support, on your prayers. That's how we should talk about this as Lutherans.
You'll find several stewardship resources at lcms.org/stewardship, lcms.org/stewardship.